Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
You tune into Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service. Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis of Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast, and you just have me, the foodie, tonight. I think I'm getting rid of the Beast. I think it's just going to be my show all alone without him. Of course, we'll have to ask him how he feels about that later, but in the interim, this is just me. So thank you so much for joining us tonight. For those of you who don't know, I host another radio show called Foodie and the Beast. It's been on air for about 10 years now, and I also do the list, areyouonit.com. I provide information and intel to the entire DC food, wine, and restaurant scene about everything that is going on. And today, I am almost humbled to be sitting in front of two titans of the wine industry. Both of you, they're pointing at each other, but two titans of the wine industry are in front of me. We're calling it the Legends of Wine show. La Caravelle Champagne's Rita Chimay is here with me, and Maison Joseph Drouin's Laurent Drouin. He is the founder's grandson and director of sales for the winemakers U.S. and Caribbean markets are both in here with me today. We are going to be talking the wine biz and their wine business specifically, and I think there's going to be some tastings in studio as well. But before we get into their fabulous wines, we are going to start with an equally fabulous cocktail mixed up for us, as always, by Todd Thrasher, the spirited advisor here at Brothers and Sisters. Hi, Todd.
Hello. How are you today?
Good. So what beautiful concoction have you put together for us today?
So today I did something a little bit lighter in alcohol. It's called It's Not Just for Osaka Anymore.
It's not what?
It's Not Just for Osaka
Anymore. Okay. And?
So it is a red shiso, which is a herb that is an indigenous to Japan. I did Koki Rosa, which is a aperitif style wine, bitter and sweet. Forged gin, and then a little red shiso syrup and vitamin C powder.
What's the difference between a red shiso and a green shiso?
So the green shiso is much more licorice-y in flavor. The red shiso is sweeter in flavor.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's it. And the color. This cocktail came about by accident one day. Because I put it in.
Isn't that how they all sort of happen sometimes?
I had made the cocktail up and it came out an ugly, murky brown color. Mm-hmm. And then I just added citric acid, two drops, and it changed the color completely. So it was an accident, a good accident, because now it's a pretty pink cocktail.
Well, it's the perfect aperitif before a big meal. It's super light, and I love the flavor and the color. It's
beautiful. Sure you needed a little cocktail before you get into the wine.
Right, exactly, because I don't have enough alcohol in front of me. So we're going to do that. Well, I appreciate you popping in. You're going to sit with us for a couple minutes, or do you actually have work to do?
I have work to do.
Okay, well, thank you.
Talk to you later.
As always. Bye.
Have fun.
Well, hello. Rita and Laurent, thank you both again for joining us. We're so excited to have you in studio. So Rita, I'd love to start with you, if you don't mind. You and your husband Andre owned a restaurant in New York for years and years. You're a grand dame of the New York dining scene. Come on, we can all brag here.
I'm a short grand dame.
Yeah, well, that's okay. I'm right there, right next to you. Good things come in very small packages.
Well said.
Obviously. So tell us a little bit, for those who don't know, about La Caravelle and sort of this dining scene that you were a part of in New York.
Yes, Andre and I purchased the La Caravelle. It existed before we came in. It was founded in 1960 by Robert Maison and Fred Decret. And we first arrived at La Caravelle in 84. And we were half owners, shared it with Roger Fessaguet, who was then the other owner. And then in 88, we became full proprietors, and we ran it until 2004. Had incredible experiences, met the best people.
It was very special. Everybody hung out there.
All the
industry people hung out there.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's world-renowned. It's so famous. But when it came time for you to shut its doors, it must have been a very bittersweet moment.
Exactly. That's exactly how we felt. After September 11, we never really got our footing back. I think there were some deep changes in the society and the way people like to go out and entertain, and the formality of it was being redefined. And if we change too much what we were, we would not be, it would be in an identity crisis. And
sure.
we didn't want that. So we decided to close in 2004. And we had introduced our champagne in 98.
How did you, I mean, here you were, you have this incredible restaurant. You already have an impeccable wine list.
Yes.
What made you decide, I think I could do a champagne better than these champagnes? Or what was it about champagne that you were like, I want to do this?
First of all, Andre and I are both passionate about champagne. We really, really love champagne.
I am right there with you. I don't know Andre, but I will say I'm right there with you.
You're in good company.
Yes. I mean, I believe bubbles should be a part of everything. You should wake up in the morning and have bubbles. It's
That's
very
so
important.
So the impetus came from Andre's upbringing. His father was the founder of the Bristol Hotel in Paris. And Andre was actually born in the hotel, room 732.
Everybody, there'll be a test
Everybody.
Later, so remember that.
It's been renovated since. <I don't know. laughs> And he used to go with his father to a place called La Halle au Vin. Andre's father's godmother was Madame Voltner from La Mission Aubryon, a big Bordeaux property. And they had special barrels made for the Bristol. So that kind of put the little bit of idea in Andre's brain. So when he had the opportunity to do it in the late 90s in New York, he said, I would like to have our own champagne. So that's how it all started.
And as you created your champagne and you were working for a certain flavor, a certain what were you looking to be a part of the champagne you initially launched?
That's a great question. First of all, in style, we wanted to be as close to La Caravelle's image as possible, a timeless classic, and something that was approachable still, despite being of high quality. It had to be approachable in price, but most importantly, in flavor profile. We also, being restaurateurs, we wanted the champagne to be very food-friendly. And in mm-hmm. addition to food-friendly, also marry with as many different types of cuisines as possible.
Well, when you launched the champagne in 98, I feel like really it wasn't until maybe the later 2000s that champagne, sparkling wines in general, had this big push, right? You
Definitely.
Know, so there's yeah. been, whereas probably in the mid-90s, late 90s, people would have champagne for a special occasion.
Exactly.
Whereas now, you know, you see, you can walk into the Line Hotel, you can go anywhere mm-hmm. and see offerings of really decent champagnes by the glass that years ago you just didn't see.
Definitely. It's a just because, you know, I feel like having something fun, a good glass. At the end of the day, champagne is a wine. So, but it's just has a wine with a party in the bottle, I like to call it.
So. Well, so as you were creating the wines and over the years, how has that changed?
So first we were working with a producer who only was doing for us a Brut. Mm-hmm. And then after we closed, we continued the champagne because we thought we were going to stop everything. But our guests told us, hey, how about the champagne?
You thought when you closed the restaurant,
yes,
champagne would be over.
Because we had the champagne originally just for our guests.
It was just
in
for
the
restaurant.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it put a little bit of an idea in our heads, and we said, actually, why not? But it was a totally different premise then, because now the champagne is a brand on its own, and I decided I wanted to do that, but it's very different than being in a restaurant.
Of course.
So I'm not really
a schmoozer,
aficionado, that salesperson, pushy. Like, I'll just go and say, hey, if you like it, great. If you don't, we're still friends and all is good. I don't
but
like
it. It's hard. Sales is very hard. And you went from being the client, so to speak,
exactly.
with all the wine people coming in and pitching you
exactly.
and, you know, wooing you.
Yes.
And then the shoe was on the other foot.
Definitely. But the advantage of that is that you know what you'd like to see and you know what you don't like to see in mm-hmm. a salesperson. So that was what made me comfortable. And it took a long time to start, but then after a few years, it really took, now it has a life of its own. But
well, what was your production like How much did you have to ramp up your production?
We didn't. Well, we another thing I should add in between is that we switched to another winery because the first winery, for their internal reasons, they didn't want to continue. Mm. So we were forced. We thought it was a catastrophe, and it turned out to be the best thing they ever did because we started to work with a wonderful winery called De Castellane, part of the Laurent Perrier group.
Mm-hmm. And a different Laurent.
Different Laurent.
There's a lot of Laurents over there.
A lot of Laurents. And we were able to add also a Blanc de Blanc and a Rosé, which we didn't have before, which really made a huge difference because you appeal to so many more people with having three different champagnes.
Well, I want to take a little break from you, and I want to get into Laurent because I have a lot of questions about your different champagnes because I feel like with the... the big push on rosé right now, rosé champagne, is so popular.
Definitely.
And just flat rosé in general. I mean, you know, rosé all day, it's become a hashtag.
That's right.
People sort of live their lives.
Definitely.
Drinking rosé. I mean, I resemble that remark just a little bit. But, Laurent, I want to thank you so much for joining us as well today. Your history with wine is just a little bit different. This is a family business started by your grandfather.
Yeah, actually started with my great grandfather.
My apologies.
I wish we had the whole night actually, so I can go back to the history. But yeah, it all started in 1880, and Joseph was living in the Chablis region, and actually he went down to Beaune, that little town of Beaune, and started producing wines based on grapes he was buying from other growers. And he was selling that pretty much to his friends locally, and just remained a négociant until he passed away. And my grandfather, Maurice Drouin, took over in 1918. I'm doing a speedy history here.
That's okay.
And in 1918, my grandfather, so Maurice Drouin, took over and wanted to continue the same thing about the négociant, but he wanted also to be able to produce wines out of his own vineyards. And it took him pretty much 10 years to narrow down and to be able to buy some Beaune Premier Cru, which is was the birth of the domain. It's Beaune Premier Cru Clos des Mouches, which is today one of our flagship wine, and that was the birth of what is today more than 200 acres in Burgundy. But in between 1928 and today, obviously, the road was bumpy during the war, very, very difficult. I mean, he was trying to find a way not to export and to ship the German only wanted to get the good stuff.
So during the war,
yes,
was the wine just sold in France? Was it sold all over Europe?
Well,
could it be exported to the States at that point?
No. You could not export anything. It was very hard to produce the wine first because the men were all at the front and could not work the vineyard. And then secondly, the Germans wanted to get, especially the Führer, wanted to get the good stuff shipped to Germany. And the national support for all the producers, pretty much including my grandfather, was finding ways to ship the bad stuff to the German and keep the good one. That was not very easy. I recommend a book, by the way. I have no interest in it, but it's called Wine and War, and it's a great book to read about history. It's a fabulous book. So after the war, my grandfather was still there, Maison Joseph Drouin was still there, and he continued to buy a few vineyards there and there, narrow down, be more precise to the region of Burgundy, stop selling some wines from the Rhone Valley, even for this from the south. And in 1957, my father, Robert, so the third generation, took over, and my father completely pruned the tree by saying, I'm going to be only Burgundy, Burgundy, Burgundy. So he stopped doing as well the vin mousseux. He stopped doing wines like Sparkling Chablis, interesting enough.
Why? I'm just curious.
Well,
was it
because
just the market at the time?
No, I don't think it was the market. I mean, if by listening to my father, he said the still wine from Burgundy really what was taking off, and in people's mind, the quality you can really get out of Burgundy without being any bubbles. We leave that to Champagne region, and I would say Cremant today probably.
There's nothing wrong with a really good Cremant.
No, absolutely not. And there are fantastic Cremant in Burgundy as well as in Alsace and in the Loire. But it's true Cremant overall. I mean, we love it no matter what. But he wanted to focus exclusively on still wine and Burgundy wines. In the mid 60s, invested in Chablis, bought about 100 acres. The region was abandoned. That was a bet because Chablis in the U.S. at that time, especially late 60s, early 70s, was very popular, but was not coming from the region of Chablis.
Well, we were talking about this a little bit off air because I said my memory of Chablis, I mean, I love a Chablis now, but in the late 70s, early 80s, the Chablis that was populating the United States markets was junk. I mean, it was a bad wine. It was not, or whatever they were selling was bad. It doesn't, you know, they just sort of labeled it, but then you told me it wasn't even French Chablis.
No, that was not even Chardonnay.
Okay.
That was not even shot in a grape variety. So that was really, yeah,
you could Rita say it. Rita is like, junky. Wait, what?
And that ruined the image of Chablis, actually, for quite some time. Chablis has made a huge comeback now. People do know, and we can talk about that later, the reasons, but people do know that Chablis is produced in Burgundy. Continuing, he expanded the domain, and in the mid-80s, so expanded also the distribution worldwide, having more structured distribution, starting with the United States and always Europe. I mean, that was the Japan was taking off slowly. And in the mid-80s, in 1987, purchased 225 acres of wheat and Christmas tree planted in Oregon, in the Willamette Valley, in Dundee Hill. At the time when everybody said to my father...
I was going to say, what vision? What an amazing, amazing vision.
That was an amazing vision, I have to say. And everybody in Burgundy just said to my father he was totally nuts to do that. And at the time, California was in the spotlight. And it turns out that 30 years after, recently one of that wine was served at a state dinner by President Trump and President Macron. So we're very proud of that. So now the fourth generation is in command. I have two brothers and one sister. Believe it or not, I have a brother who's a little bit taller than me.
I find that hard to believe. But I am also ridiculously short, so everybody seems tall to me except for Rita, who is fortunately my height. Which is so nice to look somebody in the eye for a change when I'm standing up. Go ahead.
No. So the four of us, we are now in charge, in full command of the company. And my brother Philippe is the vineyard manager and for both Oregon and Burgundy. Veronique, my sister, is the winemaker for the Oregon wines. Mm-hmm. And my younger brother Frederic is the president of the company.
Well, So I'm just sort of curious about this. When you grow up in a wine family, what is the pressure like to be a part? Was there a moment where you're like, I'm not doing this? Or was it just in your blood and you're like, this is my life. This is what I'm going to do?
Well, I think it depends on the personality. If you ask Veronique or if you ask Philippe, I don't know what their answer would be as far as pressure. I never felt the pressure. But indeed, when I was 16, 17, when you start getting a teenager, I pushed back. I was not interested at all in being a wine. All I've heard my entire life until 16, short life, was wine, mm-hmm. wine. And at some point, that's it. I'm done. I don't want to do that. And was it done on purpose? I don't know. But when I turned 23, 24, that little seed inside of me or little flame inside of me started to grow. And I realized I worked at a bank and I realized I was missing something. And the missing was the history, was the beauty of the region. I mean, the great people to work with and be able to have your name worldwide known and continue to carry on the flag for the next generation. So never felt the pressure. Even and if you ask my father, he said nope, he never did anything on purpose, which I doubt.
No, it sounds like your father absolutely knew what he was doing.
More likely,
right? Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about because you do a wide array of wines, but mm-hmm. You brought in a couple today, but I'd love to hear, for people who are maybe not as familiar with your wines, if you can give us a brief overview of some of your favorites.
Oh, my favorite wine depends on, depends on my mood.
On the hour, right.
Depend on the hour, mm-hmm. depend on which golf course I'm playing on. and it's true that we have a wide array of wines and starting with things like Macon Village or Saint-Véran, which are from the southern part of Burgundy, all the way to the Montrachet for the whites, and so it really, I would say I don't have a favorite child. Mm-hmm. There are characteristics there because wines is all about terroir in Burgundy. It's all about the location. I like the wine with a very subtle and refined and delicate and elegant, more over the structure and very deep and intense wine. So, but again, I mean, in the summertime, I tend to drink. You were mentioning rosé, or Rita, you were talking about champagne. That's the kind of wine I can have too. So, I like them all, and I have a few favorites.
Of course.
Depending on my mood. Anyway.
Well, for people who are interested in drinking wine, but maybe, you know, don't know exactly what's in a Burgundy, can we talk about the grapes that are used and what, how you guys do your wines?
Absolutely. Well, there's Burgundy seem to be complicated from an outside point of view or an outsider. Yes, it is kind of. But in the meantime, all the whites in Burgundy are produced with Chardonnay and all the reds are produced with Pinot Noir. That's simple. Beaujolais region is a Gamay and it's a different wine. Then it's all based on the location. I mean, the location in real estate, they talk about location, location, location. It's the same thing in Burgundy. I mean, one specific village in Burgundy is surrounded by vineyards and the wines produced out of that specific location have a certain character, a certain characteristic. You have to understand that we're in the northern part of the country, up the Loire Valley, And so the median part of the country. So it's a much cooler climate. It's a very rocky soil. It's limestone mainly. And because of that, there is a lot of earthiness and dryness in the whites and as well as the reds. So you're not looking at wine which are round and really kind of a, not sweet, but at least heavily extracted, deep, dark for the reds. I mean, you're truly looking at nuances and refinement and delicacy. So Burgundy are versatile. Burgundy are all about elegance, which is, I believe, the word that or the adjective that sticks to the wine. So, and it has to do with the production and the vinification. I wish we had the time to talk about it. Well, that would be too long.
Well, so with white Burgundy is what I think a lot of Americans, when they see Chardonnay, mm-hmm. you know, their heads immediately go to
big
California,
buttery.
You know, buttery, oaky. But
yes.
That's not the case at all when it comes to a white Burgundy from France. I mean, they're delicious, but they're not that big, huge, you know,
no.
over-oaked,
absolutely
overdone.
Not.
Flavor.
I've seen a change. I've been living in the U.S. now for a little bit more than 10 years, and I've seen I've met many people in the country who said, you know, I don't like Chardonnay. I've seen that shift to that, and I say, oh, good, try white Burgundy.
Right, because they don't know.
And because, yeah, they don't know, they never get exposed or never been exposed to the Burgundy wines or to the Burgundy whites. So, and when they taste that, they use the first reaction to say, oh, this is not Chardonnay. It doesn't taste like Chardonnay because they're bright, because they're clean, because they're pure, they're vibrant. They have a lot of energy. That's what you have in the wines from Burgundy. And it's the complete opposite of the big oaky vanilla. Nothing wrong with those wines. But it is not what
I mean.
No judgment.
A little bit of judgment. Yeah. A little bit of judgment.
No.
But yes,
yeah.
I'm with you. No, I. There are people who really do love that oily,
exactly.
texture.
And, yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that. Absolutely not. But for us, a real Chardonnay is more than a Chardonnay. Actually, we produce Puligny, Montrachet, Chablis, for example, Saint Véran, Mâcon Village, more than the grape variety.
So, how would you describe when you talk about your Chablis? Since we discussed it earlier, how would you differentiate that from like a white Burgundy?
Well, as a white Burgundy, Chablis is very it's a limestone and fossilized oyster cells in Chablis, and it's a very cold climate, and there was, you know, used to be a seabed, some sediments, and the wines of Chablis are flinty and chalky and almost salty as well, citrusy, and that's what you have in the wines of Chablis. Then you move all the way to the south of Burgundy, which is a few degrees warmer, and the soil is a little richer, and there is more salty and less edginess in the wine, if I can use that, in the wines from the south of France.
It's a little rounder.
It's a slightly rounder without being heavier and too flabby as well. So you in the if you're in for elegance and something refreshing and crisp and like biting either in a Granny Smith apple or in a little bit lemony as well, that's come to Burgundy and you won't be disappointed with that, honestly.
Okay, I'm in. I think a field trip is in order. I think we all need to go to Burgundy.
I'm game.
Right? Are you game? Rita's
twist
coming
my
with
arm.
Me. Right, she's like, let's go. Okay, what I'd like to do is take a quick little break. And when we come back, we'll be tasting both of your beautiful wines. Rita, we didn't really get into sort of the terroir of where your champagnes are grown, and I'd love to hit that a little bit. Sure. And then I want to talk about the wine business because it has changed drastically in the last 20 years.
It has.
And I want to hear your thoughts on both of it. So this is Nikki Nellis with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I am beastless and I'm enjoying it, and I'm going to be drinking lots of wine in a little bit. We'll be back in just a sec.
Break music from Morris, producer out of LA that's from DC. Check his music out online, soundcloud.com/pmorris. We will be right back on Industry Night. Keep it locked.
Service Radio. Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis, Industry Night with Foodie and Beast. We're back on air. We are in the glorious Line Hotel. We're actually having some lovely desserts provided for us today by pastry chef
Picheong,
thank you very much. And they are gorgeous and beautiful, and he is wonderful here. He does all the desserts for Brothers and Sisters, which is Eric Bruder Yang's restaurant, and he just opened up a new restaurant called Spoken English, also here in the Line Hotel. You have to stand. There's no seats. There are 20 places to stand. Having been just a couple weeks ago, the food is fabulous and the desserts are incredible. But I want to welcome back my guests. We have with me today Rita Jamais of La Caravelle Champagne.
Hello
and from Maison Joseph Drouin, Laurent Duren. We appreciate you both joining us today. So thank you so much. And lucky me, I have some Blanc de Blanc. So Rita, tell me a little bit about the Blanc de Blanc Champagne.
Okay, so the Blanc de Blanc literally means white of white, which is...
that much French I have.
The white grape. It's 100% Chardonnay, and it, again, like a similarity with Burgundy, the grape.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from the Côte des Blancs, which is this area of Champagne where they grow mostly Chardonnay.
Mm-hmm. And yes, put your face in front of the mic, please. So what were you... You've been making champagnes now for 20 years.
Right.
So what was it you were looking for? Like every year you have different products. So
Yes and no, because our line is non-vintage. So it's always a blend of three previous vintages.
Mm-hmm.
And
to back up a little bit, for the layperson.
Yes.
Vintage champagne versus non-vintage champagne. What does that mean?
Vintage champagne, it means it's the production of that 1 year. Only one vintage is the year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not our case. We have you see a lot NV on a lot of the bottles. It means non-vintage.
Right.
It means it's a blend of three years usually.
Mm-hmm.
And then they add to that reserve wines in order to maintain more or less the same style year after year. It's a different approach than the vintage approach. So... This particular Blanc de Blanc is also aged 3 years.
Okay.
In the bottle.
Is that a normal amount of time? Less?
The minimum required in Champagne is 15 months.
Okay.
So I think that the longer, this extra year and a half really makes a big difference,
mm-hmm.
because it allows for all the elements to blend together and to mature in a certain way, become more mellow and develop new flavors like brioche or almond, sometimes gingerbread, depending on the year. So
what is the process?
So the process is after harvest, they obviously make the still wine, so the first fermentation. And then there's a second fermentation that happens, which will be where you get the bubbles. And then they do a little while later, they do a backtrack. The first fermentation is made in our case in steel tanks, stainless steel tanks.
Okay.
Some champagne makers age the wine in barrels, but we don't do that. This is a matter of style.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's bottled, and it's allowed to ferment and age, and all these flavors that I was saying to develop. And then they disgorge it, meaning they take, I'm simplifying.
Of course. I wasn't going to call you on it. It's fine.
Good, because I'm not the winemaker. And then they basically, while it's aging, they have a capsule on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's some sediment, and the bottles are tilted down, and they're riddled by these very skilled people, or now with the machines. So there's a sediment that develops at the neck of the bottle, and disgorging is removing that sediment.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also add a little liqueur, meaning a little bit of sweetness, because, pardon me, as it is, it can be very, very acidic. And so depending on the style you want to make it a little more, a little rounder, a little sweeter, to give it a little more balance.
But with a traditional Blanc de Blanc, I mean, it's usually a very dry.
It is drier because champagne. Of the grape itself, the white grape, which has the highest acidity,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to the Pinot Noir and the Pinot Meunier, the red grapes, who have a little more body, and you feel the fruit, the red fruit more.
Well, this is delicious. I think it's a beautiful way to start our drinking. But next, we're going to try one of Laurent's wines.
Yes.
Correct, Laurent? What are we trying first from you?
We're trying a white from the village of Puligny-Montrachet, and it's called Puligny-Montrachet Premier Cru Les Folatières.
Okay, so that sounds very easy for you to say.
It's a beautiful wine.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to it. So tell us what we'll be tasting in this wine.
Well, first of all, it's 100% barrel fermented, approximately 20%, 20-25% new barrel used. It's a 2016 vintage, so it is very young as a vintage. 2006, you know, the vintage has huge importance, obviously. In Burgundy, and 16 is known to be very bright. Again, lots of energy. I mean, acidity is very edgy, but very pure. So, the wines of Puligny are known to be very. When I say very, really, you're talking about the ultimate elegance you can find in. So, you're talking about nice fruity and floral. Oh, it's so bad.
Right, I know. Yeah. It's horrible to pour it out, right?
Fruity and floral at the same time. Kind of a dry almond, a little bit of hazelnut as well, touch of honeycomb. That's all kind of those flavors you find in it. But I usually tend to say to people, just get a sip of it, and we can all agree on the texture of the wine, the fact that it is, if it has a bright acidity or it is more a little bit of a sweetness, and how long and the persistency on the palate. When it comes to describing the wine, we have our own sensation for all the flavors we can find. I can find pear and peach, and you're going to say, well, it's more lychee and pineapple and whatever. But we all agree, and that's what I call the complexity in a wine. So when we start disagreeing, that means we all agree on the fact that the wine is complex. But the premier cru from Burgundy, and the top level is the grand cru. You judge usually the wine through its persistency. I mean, its ability to deliver aftertaste for a few seconds, if not minutes. And there is a lot of things you can do in the winery to play with the wine, to make the wine bigger, to make the wine fuller. I mean, giving length to the wine and giving complexity to the wine is impossible to do if it doesn't come from the vineyard.
Of course.
And the locations. And that's the secret of the Grand Vin. So, Folatières is among the Puligny-Montrachet as a village is among the greatest of the three appellations in Burgundy, Puligny, Meursault and Chassagne-Montrachet, and within the Puligny, there are several premier cru, and one of the prestigious ones is the Folatières.
Well, I feel very fortunate and grateful to be tasting this wine in
Same
studio.
Here. It's a beautiful wine.
It is a beautiful wine. I am curious, though. I would think that a wine of this caliber, 2016, you would think it would stay in hiding for a little bit longer. Why is it that this wine can be so young and available?
Well, first of all, we are now presenting the 2016, so the wine is not available on the market. It'll be reaching the market in the fall.
Okay.
So a few more months in the
bottle. So we're really lucky.
Yes, we are. I mean, we're among the first one to, in actually today here in Washington, to be able to taste the wine. And
everybody get your own show.
So that's amazing.
And then you can get to taste all these fabulous wines.
And And it will develop and age, obviously, will gain, I would say, in subtlety. I mean, all the elements and the various layers that you can feel tasting the wines right now, and kind of la fougue de la jeunesse, so its youth is there, and that vibrancy will slightly come down a little bit and bring even more amplitude into the wine, mm-hmm. but always keeping that nice elegance in the center.
No, it's a really beautiful, beautiful wine. It's such to have the sparkling first, which is so light and effervescent and, bright. And then to have your wine next, the complexity is, obviously totally and completely different.
It's so interesting.
It is. It's really interesting because, for those who like wine but don't really know a lot about wine, they think white wine. They just don't I think without a lot of education, it's hard to understand the different grapes and the terroir and where everything comes from and how all of that creates the wine that is being poured and the care. There's so much. It's not just crushing grapes and putting in a bottle and hoping for the best. It just doesn't work that way.
Exactly. If I may add, the way I talk about the wine, there are two kind of wines. There are the technically well-made wine that will pretty much taste the same every year. Mm-hmm. And it's fine because it can bring people from they want consistency. And then there is wine with the soul. And the wines for the soul will change, will vary, will evolve. Sometimes they will please you, sometimes they will disappoint you. But that's the beauty, especially when it comes to Burgundy. Burgundy is the constant quest for the ball that will make you say, wow. And then you're going to be through a bumpy ride again, disappointed, and then another one. A little bit like golf. Every one good shot
makes you keep bringing up golf. I don't play golf, so no.
Okay. Well, it's that one shot that will make you keep going. And one more thing on the Pudini. I'm going to quote Jay McInerney, who's a novelist. He said that's the Grace Kelly of wine.
I love
speaking about the elegance. Right.
Beautiful. Well, so let's go to Rita and talk about your next champagne. Mm-hmm. Which one
My
is
next
it?
Next champagne, the Cuvée Niña.
Mm-hmm.
Watch for the sound. Okay.
Okay, that's Cuvée okay. Niña, we like it. We like the sound. Everybody should hear what we're doing. Yes, just don't hit us. There we go. Oh,
great job.
That was little.
Amazing.
It was little.
So our Cuvée Niña is the blend of traditional blend of champagne, which is the three grapes. Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, Pinot Meunier. So one white grape and two red grapes.
So for the uninitiated,
yes.
Red grapes in champagne, how people think it should be red?
Exactly. That's a great question.
I am full of them in case you haven't noticed.
That's why you're so good at what you
do. This is what I do. I ask a lot of questions.
The two red grapes, first when they extract the juice, they don't let it sit
skin
too long with the skin.
Mm-hmm.
The skin is what would give the color.
Okay.
Which is a way of making a rosé champagne, by the way.
The skin's
letting the
contact.
Skin seep. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, they leave no skin contact, so that the juice that you get is clear.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you do this blend with this one?
Yes. First, the three grapes are vinified separately,
mm-hmm.
and then they blended. In this one, we have 40% Chardonnay, 30% Pinot Noir, 30% Pinot Meunier.
And is it done in the similar style as the Blanc de Blanc, where it's several mixes in 3 years? Or
Yes, same style.
Yes. Okay, so same thing.
Except the Cuvée Niña is aged for 2 years. Not 3, after it's all blended.
And why is that? Just you prefer the
It's a matter
effect?
Of style. I think in the Chardonnay, the purity of the single grape, this beautiful grape, more aromas develop with the time, and you can really see the complexity and the specificity of that one grape. Here, it's interesting to see as well, because especially tasting after the Blanc de Blanc, you see what each grape brings to the mix.
Without a doubt.
Exactly.
No, you can really smell it.
Yeah. The Pinot Noir will bring a little more structure,
mm-hmm.
and the Pinot Meunier more fruit, floral almost.
So when you do a mixed batch, do you play with the numbers ever based on the quality of the wine each year, or does it always pretty much stay the same?
That's a good question. Actually, in our case, we have more or less the same ratio. But what changes, the winemaker also uses a reserve wine to make sure, because his quest is to have
So you start like with a starter, like sourdough bread, right? You start with a little starter.
Exactly. And then when you get the final result, the pre-final result, you add that reserve wine to make sure that you have from older vintages, to make sure that you maintain that style that's characteristic to this particular cuvée.
Sure, because for your product, I assume what's really important with the La Caravelle champagnes is the consistency.
Exactly.
Whereas with all your wines, consistency year to year is not what you're aiming to do. You're aiming to have a fabulous wine, but it totally depends on the year and where it's from and what happened.
Exactly. In Burgundy, the consistency is through the style.
The style, exactly.
It's the interpretation of what we have at the terroir. But then the wine itself, obviously, we're trying to bring the best of the best every year. And as I say, sometimes Mother Nature is not that pleased with us. But the style is the consistent. It's the signature. I mean.
Well, I'd like, to your point on Mother Nature, I'd like to talk to both of you about how climate change is affecting both of your businesses, because even though it hasn't been that warm here in DC, it is getting warmer. And how is that changing your grapes and the growth and when things are happening? Are calendars moving or things happening when they weren't before?
Yeah, well, the calendar, there is a global warming. We cannot ignore that. We have to acknowledge. And it is affecting in two ways. First of all, the date of picking. And when I was a kid, it used to be around the 23rd, 24th of September. Now, on an average, you're talking about the 18th, the 19th of September. You always have late ones, but that's usually what it is. But the biggest challenge for us is to maintain the natural harmony and balance you have in the wines, because Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Burgundy doesn't like, you know, hot weather. And the warmer it is, the more sun, they're hypersensitive, those two grape varieties, and it naturally brings up the level of alcohol, slows down the, the phenolic, which is the ripeness of the stem, the skin, the pips. I mean, it's no matter what the temperature is, so you have a kind of a delta between the sugar contained and then those phenolic. And when they're not perfectly ripe, the wines are not balanced. So the challenge for us is to work in the vineyard through green harvesting, through the clones, and trying to find one to offset, I mean, the global warming. So we can still keep up to that, but maybe if we continue to the direction we are on right now, there might be a day we'll start planting even more and start producing Grand Cru in Belgium or in Sweden. I don't know.
Right, but
move up.
More up north.
Yes. So there is, we have to face it. We're working on it. There's so much we can do with Mother Nature, trying to control her. So far, we've been successful, but I don't know, 50 years, 100 years from now, I don't have a crystal ball, but I hope.
I could totally concur with Laurent. Mm-hmm. Actually, a few years ago, in Champagne, I don't know if it's the same thing in Burgundy, but the harvest dates are they're determined by the Comité de Champagne, and then they're very strict, like you cannot pick before and you cannot pick after. But there was a year not so long ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, where they had to pick at the end of August because it was just time to pick.
You had to
do it. They had to call everybody from vacation and, you know, August in France.
Right, everybody goes on vacation.
Exactly. So it's really a problem. Champagne is a little more north than Burgundy, but mm-hmm. still it's the same trend that you see. Yeah, because you need an optimal ripeness mm-hmm. and sweetness level, natural sweetness in the grapes.
So if the fruit gets too big?
Exactly. Too sweet.
Too ripe.
Exactly. Too ripe, then you...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The way you can look at it, you draw two parallel lines. One is the sugar and one is the phenolic, so the pips, the skin, the stem. And they, in the cold climate, those two lines will remain parallel all the way to the date of picking, and that's where you have harmony in it. Now, if you bring too much heat, too much sun, then you're going to have the sugar, it's going to skyrocketing, but the phenolic remain the same. So you can feel that you're going to get a huge delta in between those two lines, and mm-hmm. that's where the wine is not balanced anymore.
Okay. So you have one more wine?
I have one more wine, rosé. The rosé.
Okay, so we'll do. So what? When did you start producing the rosé?
The rosé, we started in 2009.
Okay.
Yes.
And why did you decide to head that route?
It's interesting because while we still had La Caravelle, I kept saying to Andre and our champagne friend, rosé.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
there's
the sound.
There's the party. There we go. Thank
I kept
you.
Telling Andre, oh, rosé, champagne. And everybody was like, are you out of your mind? Men will never drink a pink beverage. So I said, I'm telling you, mark my words.
Okay, a little.
Anyway.
Yes, and you were 100% right.
So our rosé here is a blended rosé. In Champagne, there's two ways of making rosé, the mm-hmm. blending method or the bleeding method. what one letter does different.
Right.
So the bleeding, as I was saying earlier, is when you leave the red grapes long enough for the skin to discolor into the wine. So that's how you obtain the color. Or it's also the only place where you can mix basically white and red and obtain the rosé. After the same base blend than the cuvée Niña, the last step is to add some still Pinot Noir wine from Ailly and Bouzy. And then they before the bubbles, the
So is there skin contact on this wine, or is it more of, it's just addition?
No, but the red wine that is added, still red wine that's blended in, definitely.
Okay. It's a beautiful, beautiful wine. No, we were talking earlier about rosé that, you know, 20 years ago, the only pink wine that you really saw in the United States was, you know,
White Zinfandel.
Bright, sugary, terrible White Zinfandel. And I remember being at a rosé tasting and thinking, I mean, it's delicious, but I'm embarrassed to walk around with it because people think I'm drinking White Zinfandel. And clearly the people of Provence have done an incredible marketing campaign to educate people on rosé.
It's a lifestyle. It's a whole lifestyle. Yeah. That
it is. It's fascinating.
And I think it has to do as well with the consumers in the United States. If I may, my first trip to the U.S. was in 1987, so about 30 years ago. And I remember the champagne that was enjoyed pretty much was demi-sec. It was
very
famous.
Sweet,
super
right?
sweet.
Absolutely, yeah.
And over the years, look at now. I mean, people want dry champagne, even extra brut, and so on. So
zero dosage and all that. Mm-hmm.
Moving away from the sweet, I mean, shows to me that even a much better education, people are aware, thanks to you, Nikki. I mean, and it's part of
I
the
don't
education.
Think I'm really, but I think it's
no,
really
but,
thanks to
no,
both
but
of
you.
No,
but you help spread the word,
But
definitely.
You are part of it. I mean, you're the
but
one.
But don't you think you too, I was going to ask next, but I find that it's really the fact that you're out talking about it, and there is a huge explosion of people who are interested. They want to know more about where their wine is from. They want to know more where their champagne is from, where their food is from. I mean, there is an intense interest,
absolutely,
in understanding the product that you're ingesting, and people are really interested now. So there's no, you know, when we laughed earlier about Chablis and like Inglenook and junk wines, the American palate has grown up. And there is interest not just in wine, fabulous wines from France, but, you know, wines from all over.
Absolutely.
And I think there are people like the two of you who are really out there educating people, which is a priority. I believe that people were afraid of wine and ordered just what they knew.
Right. Can be intimidating.
It can
when
be.
You don't know, you just go to the names you know and that's it.
Right.
You know?
But
instead, trust the sommelier and have him or her guide you through that.
Well, and also to have a conversation about it. What do you like? Why do you like that? What,
exactly.
You know, do you want smoky? Do you want...
Bring people
okay.
into their comfort zone. I mean, trying to understand what they are in the mood for. And then that's the job of the sommelier or the retailer. And he's going to guide that person into that world. But you say we're a lot out educating and trying to get it. There is so much we can do. So you're a big part of it. Because
if I, today,
what I said was heard by, I don't know how many people, but hopefully a few.
Thousands and thousands, thousands and thousands.
Yay.
Lots of people are listening.
So truly the education has a big part of it. But you want to get the educations when there is some interest in it. And we have brought, I would say my father has brought, by traveling in the U.S. in the 60s, had brought Burgundy into the face of the consumers. And then slowly and surely people started to hear about Burgundy. And then they want to learn about Burgundy. And then their friends know a little bit. And that's where you start the whole process. You can try to educate if you're not interested on the other side as a student. You're not going to be paying attention and you keep drinking whatever you've been drinking.
No, I'm completely with you. Now, you have one more wine to pour. So what... Right, correct? What is your last wine?
The last wine is considered one of the masculine wine from the Côte de Nuit. There's two.
Am I going to be offended because you called the wine masculine? No,
well, funny enough, I mean, I described this wine like 20 years ago in New York, and I said, it's a very masculine wine, and Chambol Musigny being a feminine.
Mm-hmm.
And one person stand up in the audience and says, sir, you're not allowed to compare wine and human. And,
right.
And I said, okay, what the hell, I'm French, so that's what we do.
Do whatever
okay, we'll give it to you. We will absolutely give it to you.
The wine is Gevrey Chambertin 2016, so it's from the Côte de Nuit, or further north.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's known to be masculine. Why is that? Because the wine has a good tannic structure, some spicy notes, more dark fruit oriented, a beautiful, beautiful depth as well. It is barrel fermented. It is fermented about 18 days in a fermenting vat, and then after that, there is an aging process of about 16 months. And again, what you're looking in this one is the harmony between the tannins, the alcohol, and the acidity. And we're not trying to heavily extract the wine. You want the fruit, but not the fruit to be dominant. You want the tannins to carry the wine, but not having the tannins dominant. And overall...
Can I just back you up for a second? Mm-hmm. Again, for the uninitiated, because not everybody understands. People hear the word tannins, but I don't know if they really know what that means.
Tannin is the impression when you have some sort of a almost kind of a dryness and some it's hard to describe the tannins.
Like the palate,
makes you
like
the dryness. Makes you pucker.
Mm-hmm. It dries out a little bit. You can feel that. But then there is the dusty tannins, which it's not very pleasant. It's like eating dust. It's not pleasant. And then the real
not sound pleasant. There's nothing pleasant about that.
No, and that means where the tannins, or even when the tannins are green tannins, kind of astringent, you know, and that's not good either. So tannin is the phenolic as well. I mean, it's a big part of it. So it's the extraction of the pips, the skin, and the stem. And if it is not perfectly ripe, you're going to feel that. The tannins is a way, it's the foundation. It's the way to carry the wine through the years, along with the acidity and obviously the alcohol. But the tannins have to be present, but not overtaking the wine. They have to be totally integrated, and that's the most difficult thing to get into the wine. It's easy to produce a tannic wine. It's much more difficult to produce a wine that has that beautiful tannin balance, and I will overall give you, you know, the pleasure, but you get the grip in it, and you can feel that. And Gevrey Chambertin is one of those wines.
Well, it's a beautiful, beautiful wine. Now, this is also a 2016, so I'm assuming, since you brought two 2016 wines, that it was a very good year.
2016 is a very good year, absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's a precise vintage. It's a vintage loved by the Burgundy people because it's a reflection of the terroir. It's the reflection of the origin in Burgundy. It is. It comes after 2015, which is an extraordinary vintage as well. More a solar vintage, or more approachable. The 15 gives you a hug. The 16, you give a hug to the wine.
Okay.
Oh, beautiful.
Now, how long would you cellar this wine?
Gevrey Chambertin 2016, at least 5 to 7 years. For my personal palate, but within a year from now, well, I can start drinking it without any trouble. And aside, a lot of people believe that Burgundy cannot go, you know, you go to a steakhouse and you get a big, big steak and you go with a big cab. Again, it's great to do that. But if you can, try to do Gevrey Chambertin and a big steak. I mean, you won't be disappointed.
Yeah, I'm all for starting my evening with champagne and oysters and ending it with a big steak.
Perfect.
A big red, right? I think we can do both. And I can find wine, a little bit of white Burgundy in the middle somewhere. We can all make that work. Now, locally, are all of your wines, both of you, available at restaurants and in wine stores so people can pick them up and try them themselves?
We're not everywhere. I wish my distribution was like, you know, I could be in any restaurant then in D.C. and Maryland and so on. I mean, all the good...
We're working on it. We're working on it.
They're widely available anywhere in D.C. Yeah,
and
we're building it up. We just started last year in this market. Mm-hmm. So I know Ace Beverages has it in a number of restaurants like Fiola and...
So some of the really bad
actually,
restaurants.
Actually, Macon, where we met, we saw each other last time. They're having an all champagne dinner tomorrow night.
Oh, are they
La
really?
Caravelle dinner, yes.
Oh, how fabulous. Macon. Will you be there?
Absolutely,
oh,
yes,
how exciting. Yes. That would be fabulous. No, so you have the three champagnes.
Yes.
And that's all your product?
We also have a Listrac from Bordeaux.
Right.
It was also started at La Caravelle. And it's a very small production. It's made by a cooperative. And it's not available every year because the winemaker decides this year we'll do it, that year we're not going to do it. So right now we're on the 2012. There'll be no 13 or 14, but we just got the 15. I think it's too early to release it yet, to put it on the market for us.
Okay.
But
But it is another wine that you're doing.
Yes.
To answer to your question more precisely, I mean, Pearson is carrying my wines, and otherwise you can always contact my distributor here, which is Prestige, and doing a great job.
They have a very good name. Yes, yeah. They do a very good job, absolutely. Well, I want to thank you both. I mean, what a wonderful way to spend my Monday afternoon, surrounded by delicious desserts and amazing champagne and wines, and hearing your stories, which is... really exciting, and I'm humbled to be in your presence and hear everything you had to share today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both, Laurent
and
Rita, for
joining
me today.
Thank you very much.
And
Nikki.
To the listeners, I want to thank you for joining us today. My name is Nikki Nellis. I'm with Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I'm in the beautiful Lion Hotel drinking delicious Joseph Drouin.
Joseph Drouin. You said it well.
I don't know. Perfect. I get so nervous with my friend. La Caravelle Champagnes, and you should be doing it too. So thank you for joining us today, and everybody please have a delicious week.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO. On Instagram and Facebook @Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.